When we talk about race in America, it is easy to see things in black and white. But of course, there's wide diversity within white and black populations. Anthropologist J. Loran Maturi has looked at the cultural differences among black communities. He has a new book called Stigma and Culture, Last Place Anxiety in Black America. Randy joins me now in the studio to talk more about the book. He's also a professor of cultural anthropology at Duke University. Randy, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Tell us about this, a little bit about the centerpiece of your work and what it is you were looking at.
Very good. The book is fundamentally about ethnic diversity in the African-descended population of the United States, which includes substantial numbers of African and Caribbean immigrants. They constituted in 2007 about 8% of the self-identified non-Hispanic black people. And you could add to that the large numbers of Caribbean Latinos who are also of partly African descent. I study these populations in conjunction with a set of domestic populations of African descent, such as the Gullah Geechees of the South Carolina Lowcountry, the Louisiana Creoles of color, and a number of Native American populations of partly African ancestry that at various points have been called little races or tri-racial isolates, but in recent years have been reclaiming some of their ancestors' Native identity. And so the overarching and theoretical point of the book is that ethnic identity making is a competitive and hierarchical process that often answers a presumption of racial inferiority to a racially unmarked dominant class, and often uses as an element of its rhetoric a claim of superiority to some constituent other.
So wait a minute. Now you're talking about African descendants, so perhaps tension between Caribbean populations and what we would call an African American population.
Yes, one might call it a tension. I might describe it rather as an ambivalence. Caribbean Americans who arrive in the United States sometimes quickly and sometimes gradually become aware of anti-black racism, and often enter into very deep and long-term alliances with African Americans against racial discrimination. On the other hand, faced with the degree of stigma that every black-skinned person faces in the United States, there's often an effort to figure out, wait, I'm not like that image that's being projected here. I must somehow be different from the African Americans who are perhaps legitimately the object of this accusation of inferiority. And consequently, one hears an elaborate discourse of Caribbean culture being superior to African American culture.
And how is this manifest? And so part of my question is, what's the narrative? But what are the other ways in which one would try to manifest this and other to distinguish oneself from a minority population that's having a hard time?
Oh, very good. Well, it's discursive. One expresses these ideas to white people. One also uses it as a child-rearing technique.
So what do you say if you're Caribbean and somehow you feel like, they see me as a black man, I better straighten out this white guy. What do I say to him?
Oh, well, it varies. There is often a deer in the headlights phenomenon where people have to make a moral decision. Should I let this white person know that he's racist and is justifying his racism by declaring his favoritism for their blacks as opposed to ours? Or should I take advantage of the presumption so that I can get a job more commensurate with my talents and my efforts? It's a dilemma faced by black immigrants in virtually every country in the world where, for example, mixed race and black immigrants and Caribbean immigrants in Europe often face the dilemma of whether they will tell a neo-Nazi, no, I'm not an Arab. No, I'm not an African, in order to save themselves from being beaten.
You have an example here in the book, too, of a professional Afro-Caribbean who at some point becomes disgusted with the fact that whites have somehow seen him as an exception and feel very free to disparage other African Americans in his presence as though you're not one of them, and that leaves him in that very difficult position.
Yes, it's a dilemma. And it's a dilemma faced by middle-class African Americans also. Many of us teach our children by example and through words, in effect, not to act like lower-class African Americans. with the implication that there's something wrong with and something responsible on the part of lower class African Americans for their marginalization. We teach our children to speak in certain ways, to dress in certain ways, to move in certain ways that distinguish us from the people most vulnerable to oppression. But sometimes that pragmatic advice extends, I think, into a logical error. It was difficult in the 90s and 2000s not to turn on the television and hear either Bill Cosby or Maya Angelou or Don Lemon talking about the droopy drawers and incorrect diction of working class African Americans, as though those linguistic and stylistic traits were responsible for lower class African American oppression.
Right. Well, it also leads to the subtle message that, or the not so subtle message that there's something wrong with who you are.
Exactly.
And then you have to internalize that and figure out how you're going to navigate.
Exactly. Sometimes the articulation of distinction from a clearly inferiorizable other gives a great deal of self-esteem. There's nobody more proud than the despot of a tiny principality. But these assertions do rest on a capitulation to the premise of the inferiority of some kind of typical African American.
Well, and this is a hierarchy that if we extend it beyond, you're talking about what happens within the African descendants in this country, but this is how the game is played with whites too, particularly working class whites.
Very
At least
good.
You ain't black, right?
Very good. It's the history of all European immigration to the United States. A disproportionate number of the European immigrants to the United States came from regions where they were racially stigmatized in Europe and where they were regarded as culturally inferior and not worthy of the rights of the dominant ethnic group in the country, which was unmarked as an ethnic group. They were marked as an ethnic group.
Right.
But once they arrived on the shores of the U.S., if they could demonstrate that they were not black and that they were sufficiently hostile toward African Americans, they could join whiteness and entertain the hope of entering the middle class. And it seems with the declining economic fortune of white Americans, those who have fallen the deepest feel that they have something to lose by some minority of African Americans gaining rights and assets similar to what they think they're entitled to.
You've had some personal experience with this as well, stigmatization in higher education, friends with a Jamaican woman when you attended Harvard.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
And it wasn't exactly discrimination. I don't mean to stigmatize her, but yes, I dated the daughter of a Jamaican surgeon and a Jamaican nurse. My father was an African-American surgeon and my mother an African-American psychologist. And my friend always knew, she introduced me to Prince. She always knew the latest and hottest African-American music before I did because she grew up in New York. I grew up in relatively provincial Washington, D.C. And in our friendship, I always just assumed we were local variants on African-Americanness, the same kind of culturally polyglot African-Americanness that I had grown up with. We ate not only Chinese food, but Lebanese food, Caribbean food, African food, fried chicken, and so forth. So I didn't perceive any difference between us as being cultural. The most prominent difference I perceived was that her parents had never married and mine were divorced. But decades later, when I began hearing much of the scholarly discourse about the difference between Caribbean professional performance and African-American professional performance in New York City and the sorts of discourse of superiority that accompany it, I asked her if she'd ever felt culturally different from me. And I asked the question skeptically. But she responded, hell yeah. She had always thought of herself as different from me, which illustrates the point that cultural difference or ethnic difference is not fundamentally about wholesale cultural differences. It's about strategic and emblematic assertions of difference in the pursuit of honor and earnings.
In some ways, though, they have to be plausible if you're going to convince a dominant culture that's not familiar at all and doesn't even bother to recognize a difference.
Yes.
You've got to come up with a plausible difference. So what is it? And I think in Jamaican culture, it has to do especially with education and speech patterns. Is that part of it?
Yes, that's part of it. There are distinctive speech patterns, but there's often a strategic element to the representation of those speech patterns and other emblems of ethnic identity. So, for example, I regularly heard in these circles that Caribbean culture was superior to African American culture, and Caribbean culture was identified with valuing of education and especially exam-oriented education, speaking the Queen's English, monogamous families, and parenting within the nuclear family, and Oh, and speaking with certain patterns of diction, which I'll tell you a joke about in a minute. And yet, when I spent a comparable amount of time in Jamaica, I realized that what was being described as Caribbean culture generally was there recognized as a distinctive minority middle-class culture. It was called a middle-class culture. So basically, a minority class culture whose self-understanding is in deliberate opposition to the majority of the population of Jamaica has been reinterpreted and renominated,
yeah, okay.
renominated a regional culture. Indeed, black immigration to the United States is disproportionately professional, high income, and high educated, especially the African immigrant population. The African immigrant population is among the most educated and wealthiest continent of origin immigrant groups in the United States. Part of the logic of immigration is its selectiveness.
Right.
And so I
would expect much more discrimination, a much greater effort to put distance between me and the African American population of several generations.
Exactly, and note that what's represented as the African American population is artificially homogenized
right.
in this discursive model, as though all African Americans were poor, as though all African Americans were criminal, as though all African Americans gave birth to children out of wedlock, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera,
right.
and in fact. The rates of out-of-wedlock childbearing in the Caribbean are significantly higher than among African Americans if you look at the culture as a whole. So I wanted to tell you a linguistic story, a little joke. So this is a middle-class joke told about working-class Jamaicans in which a teacher is presented. Oh, there's a boy named Eric. And Eric runs up to the teacher and says, "Tisha, Tisha, Ari itmind Edward Ama." And the teacher replies, "Herrick, you idiot. You have to pronounce your H's."
Who would tell this joke?
A middle-class Jamaican demonstrating his or her cultural superiority to the average Jamaican. And yet, in the United States, the suggestion that the Queen's English is the standard form of language in Jamaica and the reference to its having been colonized by England, which is understood to be a sign of superiority relative to white Americans, because white Americans tend to feel inferior to England too, is a strategy. It's a strategy not only of impressing white Americans with their worthiness of inclusion, but also of disciplining their children, saying you have to act a certain way if you want to get ahead.
If you want to get ahead, especially in this culture. I've got about 30 seconds left, but I want to get your sense of how powerful this is, because obviously so many people, including white working class and underclass Americans, are so disadvantaged by this system that gives them no voice and no power.
Yes.
What they have in common with blacks of African American and every descent is obvious, except to some of them. How powerful is this cultural? Are these cultural markers, and is there a point at which you recognize, wait a minute, it's not about that. It's about what these corporations are doing to me.
Very good. Very good. Well, it seems to me obvious, most obvious in the Southern strategy of the Republican Party, that elite and wealthy whites are able to distract the working class white public with the idea that race and wedge issues like abortion and posting posting biblical texts.
Not to mention gender.
Right. They can be distracted and be made to vote along with the agendas of wealthy Republicans who are undermining union rights. I might take a second to emphasize that I regard this pattern of what I call ethnological schadenfreude, that is, constructing one's ethnic identity in opposition to a supposedly inferior other, is a global pattern. It happens in relation to Jews in Europe, among Jews in Europe. It happens in relation to Eastern European Jews, in Scandinavia, in relation to Samis and Finns, in India, in relation to untouchables. So this is just the locus classicus that demonstrates a larger pattern of ethnic genocide.
J. Loran Maturi's new book is called Stigma and Culture, Last Place Anxiety in Black America. Just ahead, the refugee experience from Iraq. Stay tuned to The State of Things.